Hi, I'm Charles Ernst, and you're listening to 90.1 FM KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio.
Welcome to Jaws of Justice Radio on 90.1 FM KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio. It's Monday morning. My name is Terry. This morning, our show will air a live interview of Fred Slew by host David Bell. Fred Slew began his legal career as a criminal defense attorney who wanted to try cases to juries. This experience has proven invaluable to him and his clients. He's highly respected among judges, clients, and attorneys alike. He has tried a wide variety of civil matters, including serious personal injury cases, important employee rights claims, freedom of speech, and other constitutional issues, and many other types of litigation. Fred Slew advocates for justice in its broadest context, and that includes both the attainment of what is just and the philosophical discussion of what is just. Stay tuned. We'll play the calendar in the second half of our program and play the 420 drug war news at the end of the program. The pandemic is forcing a reset button in the criminal justice system. When a pandemic ends, we may find we have a new normal. The old normal seems to be fading fast. Jaws of Justice wants our listeners to know we appreciate each and every one of you. A crisis on the scale of the pandemic can reorder society in dramatic ways, for better or worse. All of society pays a heavy price for decades of failing to create a rational system of health care that works for all of us. Please take care. Let's listen now to David Bell and Fred Slew.
Good morning, this is David Bell, and you're listening to Jaws of Justice on 90.1 KKFI. I'm honored today to speak with our guest Fred Slew about a legal career that has stretched more than 40 years. Out of law school, Fred was part of a law collective dedicated to the proposition that human rights are just as important as economic rights. We'll talk today with Fred about how the law has changed for the better and for the worse as a tool for change for the little guy. Good morning, Fred.
Hey, good morning, David.
Thank you so much for joining us this morning.
Hey, I really appreciate it. I'm honored that you felt it was worthwhile to talk to me this morning.
Absolutely, and just so you know, it wasn't just me that thought it was worthwhile. It was a number of members of the bar that did as well. So thanks for joining us. I think the common theme that I've heard from others, from judges, attorneys, and then my own experience with you, is that you are fighting for the little guy. And when I say guy, let me be clear, I'm not being gender-specific there because you've represented the first woman cable splicer, in Sedalia, Missouri, to a transsexual moving from male to female gender reassignment in the 1980s to gender discrimination, racial discrimination. But let's use the term little guy. What does that mean, Fred, and how do I identify the little guy? Is it I'll know it when I see it, or what does little guy mean in terms of your career?
Well, it was basically, you know, ordinary people, and, you know, ordinary people really, they don't have the wherewithal to have lawyers. You know, they don't have lawyers on retainer. So much of my work has been done on contingency basis. Of course, I started out as a criminal defense lawyer, and I think by definition, the defendants are, generally speaking, the little guy.
And why is that, Fred? Is that like a almost a power differential? You have the state with kind of an unlimited resources threatening jail time, and you have the individual that could just be crushed underneath that?
Oh, absolutely. And, if it was a serious case, it would be very rare for them to really have enough money to fund that with expert witnesses and, you know, all that it takes to do the kind of job we all would hope to do. So sometimes, you'd put in a lot more hours than what you got paid for. And you would spend your own money for an expert and never really get compensated for that.
And we'll go through kind of the starting out with your criminal history background and then move into your civil. So we've talked about the little guy. So the little guy is just the person out there trying to make it for himself or herself and her family who may not have the means to hire a lawyer or have a lawyer on retainer to to represent him or her in the judicial system. When we talk about justice or achieving some end goal, how did you view that, or how do you view that now?
Well, you know, on the civil side, we think about it as you have a harm done, and you try to balance out that harm. And you really, you can only balance it out with money. You know, you can't turn the clock back and make your injury never happen. There's compensation for it. And if you think about the scales of justice, you try to balance that out. And, you know, money, a lot of people don't like the idea. You find them on juries who say, well, money's not going to make up for what happened. But it's the only system that we have of making up for what happened.
It seems like on
the civil side.
Go ahead, Fred.
Well, you go ahead. But in criminal cases, you first of all, you try to keep something terrible from happening to your client, and even if they're guilty, you try, you know, you don't want the state to just crush them, which that does happen sometimes, despite everything you work for and everything you try.
Going back on the civil side, I do wonder sometimes what you will want the jury to do is say, listen, I want you to make that person over there stand up and look my client in the eye and tell them they're sorry and that they mean it. It's almost as if justice could be served better in some cases. Obviously, maybe compensation for past loss, but where you have some type of resolution, some real healing that goes on. And I wonder that the judge can't order that, right? The judge can't order someone who's mistreated someone to stand up, to mean it, and to look to your client in the eye and say, "I'm sorry."
That's right. It does happen. It does happen as a matter of smart defense, even, you know, to admit liability and say you're sorry, and it does happen. It's not common, but we do have, you know, we have had big changes in the law in the 80s. We started with the, you know, alternative dispute resolution. It started out as voluntary mediation. And in mediations, that often happens, that people meet together and come together and admit fault, and you've got an insurance company, hopefully, there putting money on the scale. And then, you know, it's progressed to where mediation's a cottage industry within within the law, and it's mandatory. It's mandatory in our local, federal, and state courts, which has caused there to be a lot fewer trials. And that's not necessarily a bad thing. I mean, if people come together in a mediation and feel that they were heard and that they feel that measure of justice, both by the attitude of the opposing party and by the compensation that's offered for what happened, it's a good thing.
What? By the way, before we go on, I do want to get a little bit of background from you, Fred. I've always heard when I hear you talk, you have a certain cadence. There's a little bit of what I'll call a Southern drawl. Could you identify where that's from, where you were born and where you grew up for everybody?
Well, I was born in Waco, Texas, and then my family moved out to the panhandle of Texas in an area, you know, between Amarillo and Lubbock. Part of my high school was in grade school, was in Plainview, Texas. So, yeah, there's a bit of a draw there that people still do here.
And I know you, you, Go ahead.
We moved out to Western Kansas, Garden City, and that's where I graduated from high school.
And you wound up making it through to UMKC for law school and graduated in 74 from law school. I'm wondering, Fred, looking back at your early years before law school, growing up in Texas, the Panhandle, and then Western Kansas, was there something in that experience, maybe with your family or outside of your family, that made you focus on defending the little guy?
Well, I tell you, every summer, you know, I would work with Mexican people. They worked hard just to survive, and I don't know. So that could have had something to do with it. I couldn't put my finger on anything in particular, David.
Well, that's okay. It could just be something almost innate in you, and I understand that. And I know when you got out of law school, you formed a, or you're part of a law collective, and I think you told me that the idea behind it was we would charge low fees to people that didn't have money and normal fees to people that had money. And so
that was the idea.
And how did that play out, by the way?
That, and we thought we would be the legal arm for the movement of people who were, you know, working for change. And so we were very idealistic, and we had not a good grip on the economics of the law practice. You know, we were going to charge the lowest fees to the guys who didn't have much money, and high fees to those who had a lot of money. Well, we never saw those people that had a lot of money, you know. And we did a lot of free work and a lot of very low-paying work. So, you know, we had to adapt. We had to adapt how we thought and know that we had to figure out a way to survive and make a living.
Looking on to one of your first cases out of law school, you were appointed on a death penalty case.
I was still a very young lawyer, and in those days, lawyers, if they were interested in, you know, criminal law and going to court, which is what I wanted to be a trial lawyer. And so I got appointed, and sure enough, I got appointed. There were five defendants in a jail meeting death case, and it was filed as a death penalty case, which was very frightening. And we lucked out. At that time, state law was adapting to some Supreme Court rulings about the death penalty, and so Missouri passed a really totally unconstitutional statute that had been ruled unconstitutional in another case. So Judge Moore saw the wisdom in dismissing the death penalty in the case. And he said something that really impacted me. We had five defendants. And he said, you know, I can think of five good reasons that we should strike the death penalty from this case. But I did end up having to try that lawsuit. My case was picked as the first one to go to trial. My client's defense was that he wasn't involved in this stomping death. He was playing chess at the time that it happened. All the other evidence pointed to a different conclusion. And he was convicted, but he got 10 years in prison, much less than the life in prison that was the only other possibility. He was satisfied with the work that was done.
But I know you were a little devastated, though, weren't you? At that,
listen, when the client tells you the story that he's innocent, and you don't know the truth, really, you feel a huge responsibility, and you feel a horrible guilt that he's going to go do a 10-year sentence that maybe he's not guilty of. You know, he's innocent. And I'll never forget, I thought it was so kind of him. I'm there commiserating and telling him I'm sorry how it came out. He said, listen, and it didn't really happen the way that I testified. And I felt that was a pretty generous thing for him to do, for me.
So he was actually showing you compassion in terms of the outcome.
He was. He really was. I've had that happen more than once.
And I know in that case in particular, in other cases, when I hear about some of the people you've worked with, both as a partner in a law firm, but also just as counsel on related cases, or just people that you've worked with on various matters throughout your career, it's kind of like a who's who of Kansas City lawyers. I know you've worked with at least some of those people on that case, the death penalty case.
Yeah, I do remember that Albert was appointed. Albert Reeder was appointed in that same case. And I don't remember the other lawyers, but all of them were, you know, fairly young lawyers. And we all got together and agreed that one person filed a motion to get rid of the death penalty. And after my case was tried, the others worked out plea deals.
There was another case you told me about, which I was fascinated by. It was called the Leavenworth Brothers Defense, or the Leavenworth Brothers in Wichita. And it involves, somehow at the very end, involved Norman Mailer. Could you tell us a little bit about that case?
Yeah, Norman Mailer in a very kind of oblique way. In the trial, the defendants always wanted somehow to just drag it out. There were multiple defendants who were involved in jail riots, and it was pretty violent what happened. And these were longtime convicts. And anyway, they had a witness, and trying to think of his name. I have it here.
Well, but
Jack Abbott. Mm-hmm. Jack Abbott. Jack Abbott was a lifetime career criminal, and he was a witness in the case. And in the trial, suddenly Jack Abbott dove out of the witness stand and dove into the jury box, and put his hands around a woman's neck, a juror, and then of course everyone intervened. And I think our defendants thought they would end up getting a mistrial, and that was just one of the tactics that was used. And but Jack Abbott, the judge, took care of that very, very, he was so smart. Very slowly and carefully, he would talk to each juror and say, now listen, I know this terrible thing happened, but you wouldn't hold what Mr. Abbott did against these defendants, would you? And they said, oh no, they would. And so the trial proceeded until all of these folks were back in Leavenworth Prison.
Mm.
It was a long... personally, I was not one of the lawyers involved. Albert Reeder was. He was down in Wichita, for weeks, months, a long, long time. We had a defense committee that was going to take care of the fees, and they never came through. So poor Albert and the other lawyers who were working on it were, sleeping several people to a hotel room and sleeping on the floor, and it was a very, very tough thing to go through. those guys.
And then how did how did Norman Mailer enter into this?
Well,
after the conviction,
Jack Abbott wrote letters from prison, and it ended up being made into a book called In the Belly of the Beast. And these letters were sent to Norman Mailer, and Mr. Mailer, he began to appeal for Jack Abbott's release from prison. And eventually it worked. Abbott was paroled. And God, he was out about 6 weeks before he stabbed another person to death at a restaurant.
Mm.
And then was on the run for a while. And then back in prison for the rest of his life.
Wow, we've got 3 minutes left on this part of the segment. We're talking to Fred Slough, and we'll finish up with a criminal case. And we come back after the break. We'll dive into Fred's civil cases, which include some really remarkable ones in Kansas City. But one of the ones I wanted to leave with, which I know you struggled with, Fred, was involving a child that had grown up in a mental hospital.
It was really, really, I think I would say the saddest and one of the toughest cases I've ever dealt with. And again, it was an appointed to represent a gentleman, a person who had actually just grown up in mental hospitals, and he would run away. And every time he'd run away, they would catch him, they'd put him in isolation. And when he got out, he would run again. They would put him in isolation again, longer. And a child, if you can imagine, living in isolation. And that's how he grew up. And then there came a time that, you know, there was a period in time that they started to take people out of mental hospitals and try to put them in the community. And this person got together with a bunch of other people and did a home invasion robbery. And then when everyone else left, he stayed behind, and with the husband tied up, raped the wife in the home. And, you know, there was really no real defense to the case. And even though the court ordered a mental exam, but the examiner determined that he was a sociopath and that would constitute no mental defense.
Hmm. And what was the result of the case?
Oh, God. I think the jury gave him approximately 440 years in prison.
Hmm.
And I do not know whatever happened to him. But to know that this person, he was not right. He was not he wasn't like you or me. And he obviously had mental illness in a very serious way. But I think that no hospital really, they didn't want him on their hands. And really, he was a very, we didn't want him out here on the streets either, really.
Mm-hmm.
It was a very, very hard experience, and you just get through it. Do the best job that you can. And he was not a person who would take your advice either.
Sure. Well, Fred, we're talking to Fred Slough. We've just finished up with kind of a criminal overview of criminal. When we get back, we'll talk about some of the really remarkable civil cases that Fred's tried. We'll be back with Fred Slough in 3 minutes after the Jaws of Justice calendar.
Hello, this is Joseph Jackson. Join me on Cowtown Conversations, where we will discuss matters that impact your life as a resident of the Kansas City metropolitan area. Every Thursday morning at 9 a.m., right after Democracy Now!
Now the calendar for the week of May 11th. In compliance with the local instruction, all live meetings are suspended until the all clear is given by the mayor. All Quarries Network activities have been canceled. When they resume normal activities, we will pass them on to you. The mission of Quarries Network is to provide immediate services to families surviving homicide. See Quarries Network on Facebook or their website, quarriesnetwork.org. Mothers of Incarcerated Sons and Daughters usually meets on Mondays. If you have a loved one who's incarcerated and need advice and support, Mothers of Incarcerated Sons and Daughters have members that may be able to help. Call 816-337-5876 or email misdadvocacy@gmail.com for more information. Mainstream Live with Senator Dinah Sykes will be Tuesday, May 12th, 1 to 1:30 p.m. on a device screen near you. Mainstream Coalition asks us to join a Facebook Live with Senator Dinah Sykes and Mainstream Coalition Director Michael Papa. They'll discuss the status of health care and domestic violence issues and any questions you have. This is an ongoing series from Mainstream. Thursday, May 14th, Kansas-Missouri Dream Alliance, as Showing Up for Racial Justice Facebook Live, will be 7 p.m. Join Showing Up for Racial Justice members as they discuss Kansas-Missouri Dream Alliance and any organization working with immigrants and undocumented youth, making sure that education access is available for all. Johnson County Mothers Demand Action for Gun Sense in America is online by phone via Zoom on Thursday, May 14th, 6:30 p.m. Discussion of goals for election season, wear orange, and gun violence prevention activism in the time of COVID. RSVP to get the Zoom meeting link at momsdemandaction.org. The Willow Domestic Violence Center 24-hour hotline is 785-843-3333. A list of services, meals, and hotlines specific to sheltering are available at lawrenceprogressivecalendar.blogspot.com. That's updated daily. My name is Terry, reminding you that these events and more can be found on the Jaws of Justice Radio Facebook page, as well as the Jaws of Justice Radio page on the KKFI website, kkfi.org. We want to thank all our volunteers. Our engineer today has been Bill Claus. Please listen to Jaws of Justice next week. Elisa Breitenbach will discuss the National Child Abuse Hotline.
This is David Bell, and you're listening to Jaws of Justice on 90.1 KKFI. Our guest today is Fred Slough. We've talked to Fred in the first half of the hour about his criminal cases, kind of representing the little guy that we talked about before and defined. And now we're going to go into the civil cases. And you know, Fred, I've always found bathrooms and elevators to be the great equalizers in life. In that regardless of what you are or position you hold in society, we're all going in one of those two places when necessary. And it seems like, similarly, the courtroom is one of the few places where the little guy can get the attention of the big guy or the big corporation. And it seems like your career on the civil side has touched very much upon that theme.
Well, I'd agree with that, David. You know, you're usually... In a lot of civil cases, really, it's just one ordinary human being against another ordinary human being. But the second ordinary human being has the wealth of an insurance company behind him. You know, at least that's what you hope. Because without there being adequate resources to fund the result of the case, there's not going to be a real sense of justice at the end. So I guess you could say, yeah, you're up against the little guy, against the big guy, and sometimes you are, but not really all the time.
Well, but let's talk about the first example. I grew up in Kansas City, Fred, and as long as I can remember, going to the plaza, there would be a guy that would be standing there, and he would say, I need a down payment on a cheeseburger, and I remember the first time I heard that I thought that was kind of funny, and then the second time maybe slightly less, and then the thousandth time it lost its humor for me. But you actually have a connection to that gentleman.
I sure do. Jerry the famous beggar. And I'll tell you, David, that was the most unpopular thing I ever did. If you didn't give him money, he was rude and nasty. And we used to have an office in Westport, and that was the one place Jerry worked. And so I saw him all the time, and he was always getting in trouble. And he wanted me to go to municipal court, which I did a lot of municipal court work, both at day and in the night. And he always wanted me to represent him, and I always refused. But I told him, Jerry, if they ever arrest you for begging itself, as opposed to, some incident, some dispute he caused, but if it was for begging, that I would take the case, because I knew our ordinance was unconstitutional. So, sure enough, it happened. He got arrested for begging, and so we both defended him on the case, and then sued for damages for him. And they did change the law. They changed the law to where it wasn't illegal to beg, but it was illegal to aggressively beg. And they defined what aggressive begging was. But he was such an unpopular character. I remember a municipal court judge looking down the hall and pointing at me and saying, that guy is an a-hole, put it that way.
Sure.
He was talking about my client, of course. But really, it's always brought up to me that how could you represent that guy? But it wasn't right that saying, hey, could you spare some change, was against the law. And I found that people who, the fellow that goes around town as Superman?
Right.
In Superman suit? He was another one of my clients. And,
oh, wow.
So if you're on the street and you don't fit the mold, and obviously those two guys don't fit the mold, you're subject to getting arrested for things that you really shouldn't be arrested for. So that's where you do have to fight the system.
But I guess Fred, so Jerry the beggar, just so our listeners understand, Jerry the beggar comes in. First of all, if someone were to call up and say, David, I have a potential client on the phone, his moniker includes the word beggar in it, I'd be like, oh my God, I got to pay the electricity bill here. I got a mortgage. I got to feed my family. I mean, so the Jerry the beggar is just not going to have any money. So how does that work, Fred? I mean, I assume he didn't come in with a big retainer for you.
Oh, no, he didn't. He never paid me anything, but the city of Kansas City paid for that.
So we
defended in the criminal case, and then we filed a civil matter. We get paid attorney's fees if we win the case.
But you had to take that risk.
And only if we win the case.
Right. And so how long did the litigation, do you think, probably a year or two, maybe even more, in the criminal and the civil, and during that entire period, you were not paid at all? Your hope was that you would win and that you would be paid at the end. That's the contingency fee model, I believe.
Well, I don't think that one lasted that long because the ordinance was clearly unconstitutional, and the city knew it was, and rather than make it into a long, drawn-out fight about that, they decided to settle up. And it wasn't ever about any large sum of money. And if Jerry had those dreams about getting a large sum of money out of this, I wouldn't have taken the case. He and I had to agree that our real goal was, one, get the law changed, two, get me paid, three, get him some money, you know. And we knew it wouldn't be a large sum of money, but to Jerry, it was a large sum of money.
Sure. You know what? Another case you worked on, which I was, again, growing up here, obviously Kemper Arena was a big, big place, and apparently you ran into, at least figuratively, Frank Sinatra. Well, what was that case about?
Well, I'll tell you, that was, I've done a lot of defense of civil disobedience protesters. And in line with our desire to help people who were trying to make change, I was representing folks involved in the anti-apartheid boycott South Africa movement. And Frank Sinatra would not honor the boycott of South Africa. And so it turned out that he was going to sing at the Kemper Arena over here in the West Bottoms. And a bunch of local ministers and anti-apartheid activists decided that they would block the roads into the concert as a protest. And I think, you can imagine, if you were in a car of folks and you'd all paid quite a bit of money to go to Kemper Arena to hear Frank Sinatra, and you're in a stalled caravan of cars, people were very angry. And the police were fairly rough about it, too. And my job was to take all, they're all charged with municipal ordinance offenses, to work out some kind of plea agreement to keep them all out of jail. And I did that in that case and in many others over the years. And I remember we somehow ended up in front of Leonard Hughes as a judge in one of those cases. Hmm. And Leonard himself had an experience of people going to Fairyland Park to protest the fact that Fairyland Park was segregated. And I remember he mentioned his own experience and with civil disobedience, and he thought that it would be fine if everyone got $1 fine. That's how it worked out.
Right.
Of course, that's a conviction. Do have a conviction. I always tried to avoid people getting a conviction on their record. A lot of times we were successful, but Mr. Judge Hughes didn't believe in that. He thought, if you do the crime on purpose, then, you pay the fine.
Another case that I know you worked on, and this is something that we kind of lose sight of, public space in Kansas City is somewhat at a, there's not a lot of it. And so if I have a message that I want to put out to the world, whatever that message is, there's not a lot of places I can go in a physical sense in Kansas City and holler out what my message is and hope that somebody else hears it and acts on it in some way. And I know that you've always participated in litigation regarding the First Amendment, and one of those was a bike-a-thon where a bunch of women at a bike-a-thon were arrested for protesting in a public park. Could you talk a little bit about that?
In that particular case, the police came and shut down the protest. I mean, what it was a bike-a-thon for choice, and they were going around, riding the bikes in the park and raising money for choice. And the police shut it down under the theory that the park was for recreation and that politics was not allowed in the park there. And so we basically filed a civil suit for all of the women who had been working, for the ones who wanted to be plaintiffs in the law, in the lawsuit. And, of course, what happened is the city, again, recognized that, you know, the sidewalks, parks, these are obviously First Amendment forum kind of places. And you can't keep politics out of the park. And essentially, we got a nice settlement for all the people who had had their rights violated. And that was, and they were very happy about it. And it made us a lot of friends, you know.
You know, go ahead.
Case actually came to Kathy Keneally, and she and I worked a civil case on that.
You know, another case you had mentioned to me, and again, these are small slices of life that seem to make a big difference, kind of a ripple effect that you may not read about or hear about or we may not remember today, but that have, I think, impacted all of our lives. And there was a case that you had mentioned to me about the first female on an all-male cable splicing crew in Sedalia, Missouri. Something that, you know, if I've spliced a cable on my stereo wire when I had one of those, that would be as far as it went. But this was a little bit more in-depth than that. What was that case about, Fred?
As you mentioned, and I'm really so proud of her and her courage, you know. She goes to work on this crew, and the crew, you know, to learn how to be a good cable splicer, you learn on the job, and you learn from other people who do that job. Well, they didn't want her there. And they did everything they could to get rid of her. They wouldn't help her learn the job. If she would bring, like, you know, they all met up at a central place. If she brought cookies, they wouldn't eat them in front of her. The cookies would disappear, but they would never eat them. That was just one piece of evidence in the case. Well, fortunately, she was in a union, so she had a backing accident with one of their trucks, and they fired her. But the union helped her keep a job, but they made her take a desk job in Kansas City. So she had to drive back and forth from Sedalia every day for that job in Kansas City. And she had one goal. It wasn't money. She wanted to walk back onto that crew in Sedalia and say, "I'm back, guys. You did not get rid of me." And, you know, the union stuck by her and really helped us with the case and brought us evidence that at one point in time, the person who was in head of the whole division she worked in, all these cable splicers and other kind of workers, had made the statement that there would never be N-words or skirts on his crews. And so that was our first piece of evidence that we put in to the federal court trial of the case. And this was back in the day when a Title VII case like that was tried to a judge. And we tried that case for maybe probably 6 court days. And eventually, an order was entered that we won. And eventually, she did walk right back into that job and eventually became the senior cable splicer on that same crew in Sedalia. I'm sure by now she is retired from that job. But the settlement offers were made to her. She refused. The only way she was ever going to stop was when she got to walk back on the job.
Wow.
And I really appreciated her courage in doing it. And we still remain friends.
Oh, that's wonderful. I was thinking as you're talking about that, Fred, that maybe my term of the little guy, although I've heard it around, is maybe wrong. Maybe I'm throwing in my own bias and even the term. It seems like individuals that you are fighting for recognition of these individuals as full, complete human beings with wants and desires and needs, and it's the failure of others to recognize that you're really in court to protest.
Yeah, well, it's just the biases that people have. In her case, that a woman couldn't do this job and shouldn't be on a crew, one of their crews. The bias that black people shouldn't be on those crews, and we those things don't go away. I think every generation will have to keep fighting against discrimination. I don't think it's going to go away, and I think we see in our time a rise in hate, bias, discrimination, and we just have to keep fighting it back. And the only way we do is if we have clients who stand up for their rights and file complaints and say this isn't fair. It's not fair.
You know, we have 3 minutes left, and I wanted to close out with this interview. And by the way, let me just be clear, Fred. I had a number of messages from attorneys, potentially someone on the bench who wanted to bring up various stories. I respectfully declined because I figured we could do that at some other time, because I think some of those would be would not be for this family-oriented show. But I did want to bring up this final big case that was towards the end of your legal career before you retired, and that was a case that involved a debt collector. And it seems to me this debt collection is a way in which corporations are able to take advantage of the little guy. I'm going to use that term again, and you were able to fight back against that. If you could tell us a little bit about that case.
Oh, I'll tell you, it was a wonderful experience. I got to work this with a very brilliant young lawyer, Gina Kiala. And Gina had worked this case up. This woman that we represented was a Mexican immigrant, and she had the same name as the debtor. But in the end, it turned out that the real debtor that they were supposed to be going after was a man. But these debts get sold from one big company to another big company who are going to go out and collect these debts. And they refused to recognize that they had sued the wrong person and just apologize and, pay her a little money for having sued her wrongly. They just continued to sue her. And Gina just kept fighting them, and we ended up in court with a trial that was really only about damages, because the judge had gotten so upset about the way that the plaintiff had treated the case in court that liability was determined already on our side. And unbelievably, the jury saw what had happened and saw how unfair it was and how much it had impacted our client. And they awarded her, jury awarded her $86 million. I just about fell over when I heard them say that. Obviously, the case didn't end right there, and them just fork up that money. It doesn't work like that.
Well, it would have been funny if you would have hired another debt collector to go after that debt collector, but I guess that would. It's interesting, Fred. I'm honored that you'd come on the show to talk, and I always love listening to you and learning from you. And it seems like in that case, it seems as if justice, to the extent you could have it, was obtained in that this kind of the jury spoke with almost a moral outrage at all of us being impacted by these practices in a case that seems so obvious. You have the wrong person here. Just leave us alone. They wouldn't, and you were able to fight back with using the courts, which is just truly remarkable.
It was an unbelievable experience, and so gratifying. And the like you said, the jury was outraged that they had so little consideration for this woman. And that is what, you described it well, that is what happened. They were outraged.
Well, Fred Slough, thank you so much for taking the time to be with us today. And we look forward to talking to you some more about some of your experiences and hopefully reading a book that I'm hoping you'll write in the near future. Fred, thank
you. Well, David, I enjoyed it. I enjoyed it. And to have you ask me to do it is an honor. I mean, I appreciate you very much as a lawyer. I listen to your shows. I love them. I listen to Law and Disorder on Tuesdays. I'm a big fan of KKFI. And so thank you very much for inviting me.
Thank you, and this is Jaws of Justice on 90.1 KKFI.
It's the 420 Drug War News. Courtesy of Doug McVeigh and the Century of Lies show, we have part two of a presentation by Eunice Cho, given to Physicians for Human Rights.
About 6 weeks ago, when we started thinking about COVID-19, and as Scott had mentioned, it does feel like almost a year ago, at that point in time, we began to understand that the ramifications of COVID-19 in these types of environments, in detention environments, in prison environments, what kind of impact it would have. And it was staggering. Combined with the knowledge and information that we have based on prisoner and detainee reports and our own advocacy, our own litigation, even prior to COVID-19, we knew that this was a disaster in the making. And many advocacy efforts began in essence at that point in time. The ACLU and many partners began to immediately try to alert local prisons and jails and detention centers of the dire circumstances under which these facilities were operating, and really began to encourage local officials to come up with some plan, any plan, to try to mitigate the effects of what would happen if there was a COVID outbreak. Some agencies began to be responsive to that. And indeed, there was a movement of many folks in the criminal justice system in particular to begin to consider releasing prisoners, pretrial detainees from custody to try to bring down the numbers so that overcrowding and those types of consequences would not further make the disaster in those facilities even worse. The same, unfortunately, it was not true for the immigration and customs enforcement setting. As we all know, ICE is a federal agency, and it is a quite politicized agency where immigrants have regularly and consistently are demonized as part of a political platform. And so to bring up the idea of release to this particular administration was somewhat challenging. that in essence left the courts as one of the only options to try to urge release of immigrant detainees from custody. And indeed, this has also been the case in many other systems where release has been unfortunately inadequate to the extent that there is a clear and present danger posed for people in custody. Since in the last 6 weeks, the ACLU has brought over 30 cases to challenge the continued custody of medically vulnerable immigrant detainees in around the country.
Again, that was Eunice Cho, and I thank you, Doug McVeigh, and I am Dean at DrugTruth.net.
Support for KKFI is provided by the Brookside Farmers Market. The world is changing, but some things stay the same. People eat and farmers grow. The Brookside Farmers Market has made changes to keep customers and vendors safe while shopping for local vegetables, fruits, meats, eggs, and more. The market is open every Saturday from 8 a.m. to 1 p.m. in the parking lot of HJ's Community Center, 6425 Warnall Road in Kansas City. More information on Facebook at Brookside Farmers Market or online at brooksidefarmersmarket.com.
Every Tuesday from 6 to 6:30 p.m., Radioactive Magazine, a locally produced public affairs program, spotlights individuals and organizations in our community that deal with ideas and issues of social and political significance such as climate change, racial and gender inequality, pay inequity, and much, much more. That's Radioactive Magazine, Tuesdays, 6 to 6:30 p.m., right here on 90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio.
Sitting here in my prime, what am I gonna do now? Am I gonna make it some way, somehow? Well, maybe I'm not supposed to know.
We hope you enjoyed today's show and that we leave you with something to think about, something to talk to your neighbors about, and a reason to get involved. As always, the opinions expressed are those of the hosts and guests of Jaws of Justice Radio, not of KKFI, the Midcoast Radio Project Incorporated, its staff, or volunteers. You can find our calendar of events and a link to our show on the Jaws of Justice Radio Facebook page. You can always listen to us live and find our podcasts on the KKFI website, kkfi.org. If you have a show idea or want to help produce the show, email us at jawsofjusticeradio@yahoo.com. This is Jamie reminding you our outro music is Better Man from the Playing for Change CD.